This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. Welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Kusu Chong and Ibrahim Saini here with me this morning. Friday!
Yeah, thank God.
more like Olympics, right?
I'm more excited of that rather than
Friday.
But Olympics is what? Opening ceremony tomorrow morning?
Can anyone tell me whether Hip TV will show the Olympics or not? Because
I cannot tell you that, to be honest.
All of you guys are Astro fan people.
I don't know, but no. I remember, I think it was three Olympics ago, it was shown on RTM.
It is so, like a million years ago.
Don't they always have the broadcast rights?
That's what I thought. Yeah. So particularly track and field and badminton at least.
What's your favorite sporting event?
Yeah, I think track and field is one of the best to watch.
Really?
Swimming.
Swimming.
Olympics is always about, you know, who's the fastest, strongest, highest jumper, all that, right?
Yeah.
I don't think that, archery and all that.
Archery can... I think watching paint dry more interesting.
We are set up to win a gold for archery.
It's not like a Mongolian horseback archer, right? It's one of those very simple...
You know what I mean?
Legolas.
Alright, well, since it is coming up to the opening ceremony of Rio 2016 tomorrow morning, we thought we'd take a trip down memory lane to the last Summer Olympics, the London Games in 2012. So on the breakfast grill today, we have Lord Sebastian Coe, Chairman of the London Organising Committee for the 2012 Olympic Games. Excuse me. Now, this is quite interesting because Lord Coe was in KL last year in October. Pemandu had brought him down to speak at the Global Transformation Forum. And I was covering the event and I managed to sit down with Lord Coe and have a quick chat with him. And we thought that this would be fitting to air this interview now ahead of the latest Summer Olympics. And I have to say... I guess a lot of people have looked at the London Games and said that, you know, what they did there, it was one of the most successfully pulled off games ever. So one of the most successful Olympics ever held, just from the way they submitted the bid all the way to planning and executing. And at the end of the day, they looked back and they thought, well, actually, London is a really good template of how you convert a really, I guess, challenging bid into a winning Olympics.
Fantastic. I think I agree with you. It's so well managed, so memorable.
But also, and I mean, it's London, right? How congested it is.
You know, they lost the 2008 bid. And they claim that people, you know, the organizers of 2008 weren't playing by the rules, right? They were heavy-handed. They were doing things that were not, you know, above board. And because of that, I think when they got that 2012 bid, it was justice served, or at least they felt that justice was served. But again, it was felt that they were again, you know, if I may use the word cheated, for the World Cup bid, for the 2018 and 2022 World Cup bid. So the UK likes to play fair, but the rest of the world doesn't play by that kind of rules. And
well, I don't know about that. I mean, I have to say, since then, since my conversation with Lord Coe in October, there have been a host of development. So he has been recently elected as the president of the International Association of Athletics Federation. There's a lot of controversy around the IAAF.
Did he strike you as charming? What was he like as a person?
Very aristocratic, you know, Lord Coe, Lord Sebastian Coe.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
Well, no, because he and
Good
Steve Ovett in the
you.
day.
Sorry?
They were two of the, you know, best British runners at the time. They dropped below 4 minutes, I think, for the mile.
Four-time Olympic medalist. Twice he won gold. He set, I think, 12 world records during his career. Three of those world records he set within a space of 40 days.
Wow.
So really, he's a hero in track and field. And then after that, he came back to Britain to be a member of parliament for the Conservative Party.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is he part of the aristocracy? You must.
I think so.
Hello, Melissa.
I think so. And, you know, so celebrated hero on track and field, member of parliament in British politics, and went on to bring the Olympic Games back to Britain after 64 years. So I think lots to discuss with Lord Sabco. Now, we're going to be playing excerpts of that interview on the Breakfast Grill. Just talking about, you know, the challenges of being a host country and what Rio can learn. So I'm going to be asking him about Rio, what he thinks about
Rio. Yeah, I think
Rio.
After the highs of the London Olympics, you know, I just see all the headlines, how Rio is being besieged by all kinds of problems.
Absolutely.
Infrastructure problems.
Yeah, infrastructure all the way to health.
Yeah,
scare,
Zika, athletes staying away, you know,
and
terrorism.
I think the most important thing is that at least in London, they did not develop a lot of these white elephant in terms of these stadiums.
Right.
But in Rio, oh my God, it's just, it's no one can actually imagine many of these buildings to be put to use after the Olympic Games.
You know, there's been a lot of debate around the economic effect of hosting a world sporting event.
Of course,
like this, right?
Yeah, if you don't pull it off, it's quite calamitous.
Yeah, because, you know, as a developing country, wouldn't you want to use all that money for education, for healthcare, rather than
building? But this is a double whammy for Brazil, right? Because after the World Cup, they invested billions of dollars in that event just 2 years ago. They're investing in another round of billions in this Olympics. They're down double in that sense, and I don't think they have the right infrastructure to actually manage that kind of in developments going forward. I don't know whether this is going to bankrupt them outright the way we saw with Athens in 2004.
But do you think it's a matter of timing? Because, you know, with what's happening with Brazil, when Brazil won that bid, it was, what, 7 years ago?
Look,
and
I mean, when Brazil won that bid, everything was peachy and
hunky-dory.
They had just found oil, you know, they had riding a wave of optimism.
Part
of commodities
BRICS.
Was booming. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know.
Actually, that was the time BRICS was coined, actually. Yeah,
yeah, well, that time. Before that. But
so now the president's been impeached, the former president facing trial, you have the health
Zika virus. But you know what? The Brazilian real is the second best performing asset class in the world.
Really?
The best is, I think, silver or something.
Is it coming from a low base?
Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a couple of years ago, the real was like boogered, you know.
Okay, all right. Well, a trip down memory lane as we look back to the previous Summer Olympics, the London 2012 Games with Lord Sebastian Coe, or Seb Coe, as he's affectionately known amongst athletic circles. Lord Sebastian Coe, the chairman of the London Organising Committee for the 2012 Olympic Games, on The Breakfast Grill, 8:05. And after the look at the London Games, we will take a look at the Thai referendum this weekend. Now, Thailand's going to face a new political test on Sunday as the country heads to the polls for a vote on the new draft constitution. Leading up to this referendum, the military junta have imposed further restrictions on Thai citizens to avoid them going against the draft charter. So what we want to do today on Current Affairs is basically take a look at what's happening in the streets of Thailand ahead of the Sunday referendum.
Yeah, it's quite a simple one, isn't it? Is either a yes or no to the redrafting of the constitution?
Yeah,
times. Everything is beholden to the monarchy. So despite the political parties that exist within the landscape, including the red shits and the yellow shits and so on, everything will submit back to the monarchy. So I guess in that sense, everything's stable, but they're not really the bastion of democracy.
What do you guys think about referendums? Do you think is it democracy in action?
Do you think sometimes the majority may not know the best?
But
then the power is, you know, vested in the person who calls it and what kind of questions are being asked. I mean, the Thai referendum has been criticized for being too blunt and
so just yesterday we spoke about this, right? The parameters of investigation of a local bank here was set by the board of directors. Just like a referendum, the parameters of the referendum is set by someone else. It's not set by the people. So it's essentially, I'm preparing two dishes. You have to choose either A or B instead of you going to the restaurant and asking what you want. So a referendum, in essence, is just that. Somebody already made that option and have limited it to two things.
But that's elections or so what?
Actually, elections, you can still run for yourself. You can't put your choice in the referendum. Right. So that is where that that democracy's element has been taken away from that referendum. And speaking of which, again, back to that whole setup of how a country like Thailand is fixed, right? It's not necessarily the most democratic country in the world. Therefore, this referendum is, you know, it doesn't serve the democratic purpose as much as they would like to think it would.
Well, in the UK's case, people would have said the Brexit referendum was a wrong choice because, you know, because of the consequences. Mm. But I think in certain countries, you know, with unpopular leaders, if you went ahead with a referendum and said, you know, should this person stay in office, yes or no, I think in certain countries that answer would be quite a vigorous no.
Well, I have to say, though, that with any kind of referendum, any kind of voting, you have to have the full information before you get to the ballot box,
right?
Well,
that's the thing with Brexit, you see.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't know.
Well, They didn't bother to read the paraphernalia.
Well,
do you know what I mean?
Google released
They just played on people's emotions.
Well, Google released the search results after the Brexit referendum. Apparently, the most searched question in Google was, what is EU?
Yeah, but
can
this
you
happened
imagine?
After the referendum,
no,
right?
Just before the referendum.
Oh, just before. What
so
is EU? Okay.
That really showed people went in not knowing what they were voting
well,
about.
Well, I dare you, Melissa, to go into the Malaysian, you know, rural heartland and ask people what is Brexit or what is you
1MDB?
Know, what is, yeah, exactly. They'll be like, they don't care. They don't know. They don't care. They're focused on the here and now. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the last element is on enforceability. Referendum is just a suggestion. So that is the other element.
Well, it
that
puts
I'm
in the sequence a step of events,
about.
Just like in Brexit and right. Article 50. You know, you already voted with your feet, so sorry, la, you know. Do you know what I mean?
Okay. Sunday is the day, D-Day for Thailand. We are going to the polls to vote on a referendum on the latest draft of the constitution. We're going to be covering that on Current Affairs. On The Property Show at 9:35, Azura Rahman speaks to Chung Kim Lung from the House Buyers Association about the truth behind LAD payments, the liquidated ascertained damages clause in sales and purchases agreements. Now, what this is that home buyers think that they have the assurance of compensation if their houses are not delivered on time by developers, thanks to the LAD clause in the SMP agreements. But is this clause all that it's said to be? We're going to delve deeper into that.
Isn't Chung Kim Lung the Equal World guy?
No.
It's not?
He's a former Brigadier General, right?
Is that along those lines, yeah.
He's an army guy.
He's always been with the HBA, long-time regular
which,
guest.
We spoke about him yesterday during the 9 o'clock segment where the affordable housing benchmark was brought down to 165,000. So he's been with the HBA for the longest of time, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, because that's a good idea. I mean, theoretically, if you buy off the plan and they say they're going to deliver by August 2016 and they deliver in, you know, whatever, you know, September 2017 or 2018, you are theoretically allowed to sue the developer for damages. And I think this is... Do you know what I mean?
Really? So
that's what
you
it is,
have
right?
some
you can.
Protection.
You well,
can,
that's what it's supposed to be.
But that's exactly what Chung Kim Lung is arguing. The real case that has been brought to court,
because,
you know, it's very minimal.
Correct, so, and because developers have this whole battery of lawyers working
right.
for
yes,
them.
Yes, and a whole battery of laws to protect them as well.
Correct.
So when you
correct.
Think that you have LAD, these developers have 5-10 other
correct.
Laws to protect
correct.
Them.
Correct.
Okay, so
correct.
I guess I know if you want to know a little bit more about this, this is the show for you, The Property Show at 9:35 a.m. If you missed that, you can download the podcast at our website. Quick look before we move on to other news. Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin will make an application to register a new political party soon, he says. Now, he's confirmed this in a posting on Facebook. He apparently met with former Prime Minister Tun Mahathir and the former Kedah MB Mukhlis Mahathir, several others, on Wednesday night, and they have agreed to register this new political party to which Muhyiddin will be the leader.
Do we need more political parties? I mean, we've got them coming out of our ears, haven't we?
I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, right? The more the merrier, don't you think? More
well,
choice for all?
Well,
the merrier gets
bigger. No, it's actually a bad idea. It's actually a bad idea. It's a worse idea than I've ever presented because it will split the votes. Because the example that can be given is the Sungai Siput and the Sungai Besar and Kuala Kangsar votes, remember that the UMNO votes only went up by 1 percentage point, but the margin went up from a few hundred to 5,000 vote majority. And the reason is because that 5,000 was taken up by a new party, by Amanah. Assuming, under simulation, right, the same numbers happened where everyone who voted for Amanah votes for PAS, then you're going to get the same amount of majority. That's exactly why having more majority, having more political parties is actually bad for the opposition. It's good for the government, for BN, but not necessarily good for the opposition.
But from a democracy standpoint, don't you think that, you know, if you should have a political party that represents your principles and your beliefs, and if none of the current political parties are doing so, why not another one?
Well, I'm not saying the Americans are right, but, you know, there's only two to choose from in America. And, you know, it's not as if it's like, it's not like you get something new, you don't like it, then you just discard it and you start a new one. It's a bit like spoiled, you know, cheese, right?
Yeah. So to point back to that spoiled cheese and what Melissa was saying, let's have a party that represents, you know, my interest.
Or reform what you've got.
That's one option. I would rather have a political party that can trump the existing establishment. So you have to choose between the party that represents your values versus the party that you can half bet on and can win. That's exactly what is being offered currently in the US, where not many people are happy with the choices that they have right now with Hillary Clinton, with Donald Trump, whatever, right? But at least they can align with, you know, some of the values of one political party, and they can see that political party actually winning it.
I think we're kind of like on the same page, but for differing reasons. You know what I mean? Like,
okay. Yeah. Well, I'm on a completely different chapter. I'd like to see what this is about. I mean, I don't get the calls that I've seen, you know, news reports and politicians saying that, oh, a new party will cause disunity or will split votes. I'm all for more choice and more, you know, I don't think a dual party is necessarily the best system of democracy. But, you know, I stand to be proven corrected. But let's find out more about this new party. I wonder what it's going to be called. Yeah, we'll find out. Registrar of Societies is where the former DPM has to submit his application if he wants to register a new party. 6:16 right now. Let's move on to other news shortly. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning. That was Friday by JJ Kale. How appropriately named, since it is Friday. It's a good song that gets you in the mood heading towards the
weekend. It has that chugging tone. I feel like I'm chugging along a train or something.
Do a little bit of a jig studio. Yeah, very nice. Okay. All right. 6:22 right now. I'm Melissa Idris with Kusi Chuang and Ibrahim Sani. Now, the 30% target for women in board representation, board representation of women has not been achieved anywhere around the world. Malaysia as well. I think it has been achieved in the Scandinavian countries, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah. When you say around the world.
I correct myself. But Scandinavian countries?
Yeah, Scandinavian countries, they have met it.
Sweden, that's right.
And sorry to cut you off, but I think the reason is because they allow for women to come back to the workforce and resume their duties as per normal. Because, as you know, women would take time out to raise kids. Once the kids have stabilized to, let's say, toddler age or even kindergarten age, they can come back. And it's so seamless for them to rejoin the workforce. And I think that element is still missing around many parts of the world, actually.
So in the UK, it's about 25% of women on FTSE 100 boards. In Malaysia, it's only about 10%, one of the lowest in some of the chapters under the 30% club, which is one of the bodies promoting this this effort. However, I guess, you know, the question is an age-old question, is whether governments are responsible for this, whether quotas are, in fact, the way to achieve this goal.
Okay, let's establish, firstly, that gender diversity, or even, in fact, diversity on corporate boards is always a good thing. And there's actually statistical evidence to prove that this is accurate. And then you move on to the fact that in most corporate boards around the world, it's predominantly men, and in, you know, white countries, it's predominantly white males.
Yeah.
And in Malaysia, of course, you get predominantly, you know, male Malay men on GLC boards. Not saying that's a bad thing, but more diversity is a good thing. I think, you know, glass half full thing. And then you go on to say that quite rightly, governments think that there should be more gender diversity. And I think in Malaysia, that quota or that level is 30%. We haven't gotten there, nor has it in the UK, intriguingly. I think 26% is where it's stuck at and has stuck at for many years. And what is more distressingly, writes Sarah Gordon from the FT, is that new appointments have also been still, irritatingly white male. Mm-hmm. So she writes, and she wonders out loud, is it more effective? Will it be more effective for the governments to step in and make it a quota and a requirement? I think in Sweden, they're trying to make it a quota, an official quota. They haven't quite gotten there yet. They're still trying to push it through the legislative bodies.
Norway, it's been implemented. Germany as well.
Germany's implemented. And I think it's working there.
But I think it's also that notion of culture as well, because in Italy, Italy is the only country that has the lowest women in the workforce, lowest women board representation, and they are dragging down the European average altogether. Just like in Japan, Japan has the lowest women in the workforce and lowest women in board representation. It's dragging down the rest of Asia. So it's not just about government intervention. Sometimes they have to look at the culture as well.
So
maybe the Italian and the Japanese don't like women in the workforce. And how, no matter how much quota is being introduced, I don't know whether you can move that cultural needle up front.
Well, this is not just in the workforce, but in decision-making positions, right, on the board. So is that a yes? Do you guys agree with a quota?
I think, quota's always a good thing because it ensures that a certain level is being met. But Malaysia has had a quota for many years. We've seen how it can be abused. We've seen how it can be mismanaged. So
you have token representation on boards. You know, I've seen boards where they've elected their wives and their sisters just to fill out that quota. I don't
think,
I am personally against a quota.
And that's the reason why you need women representation in the workforce before you can have them in the decision-making stage. How can you be a decision-maker if you haven't been in the workforce? That's why it's not about getting women in board level or management level. It's about getting women back to work, right? Particularly after they have left the work service because they want to raise family or because of whatever reason, right? The allowability for them to come back and rejoin the workforce would allow you to have a greater pool to choose from women when they have to make decision-making.
But the problem is, even if you do have a pool to choose from, those choices are biased, right? They're not being chosen for whatever gender biases that there are. Now, I have to say, I'm not for a quota. I don't like the top-down approach of having policy put in place to have this 30% representation. What I am for is the education of men. The only way to change this is to get the buy-in of the majority, which is the men.
This is so interesting because So I just spoke to this lady, Mariam Lee. She was in the news very recently because of some of the things that she has done. But she says that in order for us to have a more comprehensive outlook on how gender is being brought about, you have to fulfill three requirements. If you want to have a panel on something, right, a panel discussion, the first rule to test is whether or not it's a single gender panel. So you must have at least one mixed gender. Rule number two is women must not only talk about women issues. Women have to talk about other issues as well. And rule number three, men have to talk about women issues. So when you have these three laws in place or rules in place, you're going to get that rich conversation that we all have been wanting.
Yeah. Okay, so that's quite theoretical. I would go further to say, Melissa, I think you're right because quotas are not always a good thing.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a hybrid approach where governments step in and say, look, and the main reason why women fall out of the workforce is to have children because, traditionally, men are the breadwinners, women are lady eggs and manage the eggs, right? We don't have
lady eggs.
Lady eggs.
Sorry.
It's also lady eggs. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Also called the ovaries, but go on.
Yeah. Because at the start of it all, everybody graduates. We've all got, we're armed with degrees and diplomas. We enter the workforce, but it's because of childhood childbirth. Mm-hmm. That's the one. that women are forced, kind of like forced to drop out of the workforce. But if we have a framework whereby men have an equal responsibility to look after the child or to share the duties, and workforces and employers are told to have that framework in place, then I think we've got a chance.
Oh, so that's a little bit of a hybrid,
In the Scandinavian countries, because men can take paternity leave up to 1 year.
Flexible working arrangements. that, a paternity leave. Because
paternity 1 year leave would allow for the wife or the spouse, the lady, correct, to go back to work.
So in the UK, if you have a child and you're female, you're allowed to take 9 months maternity leave. 9 months, and you get your full salary. But with men, you only get 2 weeks. Do you know what I mean? So if you equal the pendulum...
Can I point out something that's specific to Malaysia? We have a very high birth rate. So if you're talking about an average family of, say, 3 to 4, and that's a year off for a mother, that's 4 years of paid salary for
the
employer.
And that's the thing, in the UK, a lot of employers will say, look, I mean, if I hire you and you're a woman, will you be taking maternity leave, you know, soon after that and take my 9 months of paid salary? And it's a big... So there is no right or wrong answer. You know,
and I think
mean?
That's why we're stuck at this percentage of women on board representations. Okay, well, it's a complex issue to be discussing. We can't get it through, but we will keep talking
about it. Sorry to be discussing this on a Friday morning.
It's coming up to 6:30 now, the first news bulletin of the day with Audrey Raj, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. It's now 6:40. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Khoo Swee Chuang and Ibrahim Sani here with me. You just heard Paul McCartney there with Another Day. It is Another Day. In fact, in Another Day, we're going to see the opening ceremony of the Rio Olympics.
Oh, I see how you did that.
Thank you. It's so smooth, Melissa.
24 hours to go. I think it starts 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning for our time. This is going to be 11,000 athletes competing in 42 sports over 19 days, described as the greatest show on earth.
You mean it's not Disneyland?
That's the greatest place on earth, the happiest place on earth.
They should hold the Olympics in Disneyland.
Oh, great idea. Oh my God, I can see the Mickey Mouse ears already.
Yeah, exactly. Has it been 4 years already since London?
I know. Seriously. I know. So far, and do you believe it's August already?
So I'm double whammied here because... you know, it seems just like yesterday I watched the opening of the Olympic Games, the one that happened in London, you know, and now we're in Rio.
Yeah, it just seemed like yesterday Usain Bolt was, you know, striking the pose.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he will be, and I'm pretty sure he will be doing that soon.
He's running, yeah?
He's running.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess a few people are not, so a few athletes have chosen not to compete in this year's, in this Summer Olympics. They're too scared of the threat of the Zika virus.
Well, in the professional golfing circles, exactly, you know, I think Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth, all very famous outers of the Olympic, you know, events because of Zika virus. It's not nonsensical. I mean, in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
they've
gotten a lot of backlash for that. But I don't know. Is it a personal choice, right?
Personal choice, yeah.
You don't want to expose yourself.
But it is the Olympics. It's the most, you know what I mean, the highest accolade you can get as an athlete.
Well, the South Korean team has nothing to worry about because they have designed a Zika-proof uniform.
And this is brilliant, right?
No, it's not. It's not. It's ridiculous.
I think it's brilliant.
Okay, why do you think it's brilliant?
First of all, it's not, you know, people say it's the Zika mosquito. It's not. It's actually the Aedes mosquito. We have it here all the time.
Yes.
In fact, I just got bit by one, you know, going into the studio.
I just got bit three times on the way into the studio.
But the, you know, the one that is being repellent is the dress. It's the Class A suit. Where, you know, you wear during the opening ceremony, not when you're like running or swimming or whatever, right? And it's when you're running and swimming and all that, you're in that track and field area or whatever, that arena that you're in, but outside you can just don your jacket, your blazer, and voila, you're repelling all the mosquitoes.
So this blazer is infused with insect repellent. Well, you want to go around smelling like Ritzek all day.
Well, bygone, do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
You'd be like why wouldn't anybody talk to me?
Interesting aroma coming from you.
And if you're, you know, you'll have South Korean athletes fainting in hallways because they've just been over... No, okay, I'm being facetious here. But... I fail
pretty,
to see.
I'm pretty sure she's like odorless, right?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know. I mean,
it would be odorless, and it probably smell like, you know, some
dish Korean
or something.
Stuff. Yeah,
I don't know.
Maybe garlic or something.
I think they're trying to make the contingent feel a bit better, perhaps.
But I think it's ridiculous because come on, there's only one opening ceremony, then 18 days of competition. You're not as if you're gonna be rowing or running or jumping or cycling or whatever in your blazer. And look, the mosquito, they don't know whether you're this or that or the other. They're going to be biting you anyway.
Apparently, yeah. Mosquitoes bite some people more than others.
Yeah, that's
right?
True.
Yeah.
White people especially.
Some kind of pheromones that you give out.
They see a white person, they'll bite the white person.
I swear to God. I think they're colorblind, John. I don't think mosquitoes are racist.
If I sit no, with my wife
because every time I'm around
outdoors,
my buddies... They say, hey, how come they bite you? They bite me.
That's true. Right. I sit with my wife outdoors in front of our porch, right? And
your
get
your
packed.
Wife is from Australia?
No. She's from Kelantan of all places. But yes, she'll be fine. She will be absolutely fine.
It's true.
Are they resistant to Kelantanese? What's the story here?
No, I don't know. I think there's a term they got, darah manis.
Well, you know, Australians, they love their beer, right? So, you know, obviously the blood vessels, you know.
Again.
It's also called a heart attack,
wrong.
Yes.
So okay. Wrong. Okay, let's get back to the Olympics because not only do we have Zika-proof uniforms, but I guess with the Summer Olympics just around the corner, there's been a lot of a spotlight shone on the Olympians themselves, how Olympians are technically, they're quite poor because they don't, if they don't receive federal funding and they don't have a huge sports branding contract, endorsement contract, how will they survive? Sometimes they have to have regular jobs.
Well, it's not technically broke. They are broke because, I mean, not every athlete's Michael Phelps coming from the US. You know, out of like say 5,000 athletes, you probably 4,000 of them have don't have endorsements or sponsorships. I mean, remember that Namibian swimmer who was applauded for his participation in the pool, but he was painfully last and by a long, long way. I don't think he's adorned with any kind of endorsements. Mm-hmm. Even in Malaysia, we don't have that many.
So, the Olympics now no longer is just for amateurs, right? I mean, now the professionals can participate.
That's right.
Because I remember in the for a large part of the time, it was only amateurs only, yeah.
Okay, but that apex that we're talking about, that is so true because if you see many of these countries, they spend hundreds of millions of dollars in the development of these Olympians. In China, for instance, they spent over $170 million, in Russia. But many of them grow up away from their parents. Imagine a boarding school, right? You've been groomed to be a gymnast from the age of 9 or 6 even. And you know, your lifespan is extremely short, maybe 12 years when you hit 19.
Your career.
At the apogee of the athletics industry, you've got the Americans, right? And then you've got the rest of the world. Don't even talk about an African athlete. Talk about the US. According to the story from the sportsgrid.com, only five of the top 10 Americans athletes make more than $15,000 per year. And compare that to someone who tosses burgers in a fast food restaurant, he makes $31,000.
Yeah. So he makes less than half of the burger tosser.
Burger tosser,
yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. So that's not just in the US, it's everywhere around the world. Yeah. So one would question, why would you spend or dedicate your entire life to be an Olympian?
Hey, didn't I see like in Malaysia, if you get a gold medal, you're going to get 1 million ringgit or something?
Yep. Perhaps so even a datuship, yeah.
So definitely a datuship. Really,
it's a million ringgit for a gold medal with 5,000 pension for the rest of your life.
But that's all right, isn't it?
For a silver medal, it's
Zhong
about
Wei
500,000.
Like, come on, bring it on, right?
I've had this discussion with Julian whether that is in fact the right way to do things, whether, you know, having a cash incentive for a gold medal will push the athlete a little bit further. I don't think it will.
I don't think
that athletes will go an extra 10% just because it's a cash prize. I think the cash prize is seen to be a gift after bringing glory to the country. Yeah, you know what I mean?
And I kind of agree with you there because the Olympics, there shouldn't be any monetary gain because remember, if you're fencing or, you know, if you're a choreographed swimmer, you don't think
Come
about
on,
the money.
Guys,
you
get
think
real.
About
this
the goal.
This is real life here. You've got bills to pay.
But the Olympians
and
are
you've
not.
Been, you've been poverty stricken for almost all your life and you've been giving your all, you know, to train for this one event. Hey, $1 million is $1 million, man. You know what I mean? And if you're 28 years old or 25 years old for that matter, or 21 years old, you can kind of like, okay, retire,
you know,
after that.
Most countries only give the cash reward to the gold medalist and not to the silver or bronze.
Or anyone else.
What do you guys think about that?
No, like, come on.
I think that's quite discriminatory.
Silver, I think they make 950 and bronze 900.
And to think, right, the one that differentiates the silver and the gold medalist is like milliseconds.
Milliseconds.
So
you're
losing, it's an all or nothing bet on that $1 million based on that millisecond.
If they make tiddlywinks an Olympic sport, I will compete. And
what
I'll
is tiddlywinks?
You don't know tiddlywinks? Oh, you know, it's like, you know, plastic discs and you make one jump over the other. So It's not a real.
Yeah. You're not going to get fit. Pretty sure it's not a real Olympic sport, but yes. You know, I mean, Nicole David can't compete in Olympics because they don't see squash as an Olympic sport, yeah. Let alone tiddledywinks.
Tiddledywinks, okay, all right.
But is squash a sport this year?
No.
No, right?
No, yeah. No, still not. Yeah, no. Okay, it's coming up to 6:49 right now. We've got news at the top of the hour with the headlines of the day. But first, Sheryl Crow with Every Day is a Winding Road. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.